Good afternoon, everyone. This is Barry Mandinack from Virtus Investment Partners. I want to welcome you to today's live panel discussion. Our panel is going to be moderated by our chief market strategist, Joe Terranova, and will feature three portfolio managers from our investment partners, Ben Caron, Doug Foreman, and Peter Newell. Ben Caron is a senior managing director and portfolio manager for New Fleet Asset Management's multi-sector fixed income strategies. Doug Foreman is chief investment officer and portfolio manager for Kayne Anderson Rudnick Investment Management, which is focused on high quality, high conviction equity investing. And Peter Newell is managing director and senior portfolio advisor for Vontobel Asset Management, which focuses on bottom-up fundamental research to identify opportunities in global equity investing. Gentlemen, I welcome you all to the call and appreciate very much you being here. What I'd like to do now is turn it over to my friend Joe Terranova to set up the call, discuss the markets a bit, and then exchange some questions with our panelists. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you very much, Barry. And I want to welcome everyone who has decided to call in this afternoon after the market closed to listen to our three panelists discuss the capital markets. What I would like to do is, before we begin with the questions to the panelists, I'd like to just engage all of you in a brief conversation of what the outlook might be for 2018, how the environment has been so far in the first 3 months, and how it has changed from 2017. It is clearly distinctly different in one area that all of us can candidly observe, and that being volatility. Volatility is rising once again. Performance of the market is not much different than it was in 2017 when you look across the landscape and you look at the equity investment world. Once again, the NASDAQ continues to exhibit a strong performance, up 5.5% on the year. The S&P is up 1.4% on the year. The Dow Industrials are up marginally. And small caps, as representative by the Russell 2000, are up nearly 3% on the year. In the taxable fixed income area of the market, year to date, we have witnessed modest declines, despite the fact that we have seen interest rates rise over the last 3 to 6 months, and we are working under the projections that rates will continue to trend higher. So all of that collectively, that environment in terms of performance that I have described, is somewhat similar to 2017, but clearly something is different. And what is different is the volatility in which the markets will conduct themselves in 2018. Ladies and gentlemen, for all of you on the call, I ask you to please prepare for what will be a year of continued volatility. The volatility will persist, and the volatility will dictate that you focus on managing risk. And once again, as is historically the norm, the management of your risk in the marketplace is yours alone. You see, ladies and gentlemen, what has happened over the last 5 years is that central banks have managed the risk for us. They've managed the risk for us with an incredibly low private sector borrowing costs and continual purchases of treasuries, mortgage-backed securities, QE plans, both here and globally. In essence, these central banks have been the world's largest hedge fund. And what has happened is we are witnessing rates rise. We are witnessing the removal of that stimulus. And we are once again the stewards of the capital, and we are the stewards of the risk. And in that, that does not prescribe that the performance is going to look much different, but it does mean it is going to feel different. One of the obvious things so far about 2018, and we'll discuss this with the three panelists, is that bond proxies, which have been so important and integral in the search for yield strategy in the last 5 to 7 years while these central banks have embarked upon becoming the world's largest hedge fund, those bond-like proxies, in terms of portfolio allocation, at this time, it is warranted to look at bond proxies and reduce the allocation. Other than that, when I talk about managing risk, the most important thing all of us on this call can do is to be diversified, to look at all the asset classes and to be inclusive in all of them and treat them as being innocent until proven guilty. So I ask you on this call today not to think so much about where the next 10% in the market is going to be. In 2018, that might be a very foolish narrative, an objective that will fail. Rather, I ask all of you to understand how you're going to manage risk in a more volatile environment that dictates being present and allocated to a broad selection of asset classes with one distinction from 17, and that being the bond-like proxies. That is where you want to adjust the allocation. You want to, in 2018, look at things like energy, which has underperformed in years past, and once again, include that in the conversation of constructing a portfolio. Technology, lastly, is the singular most important component of the U.S. economy today. It is an economy that is focused on time and convenience. We are not a bulk economy of the past. Clearly, when you think about the troubles of GE, General Electric, it's indicative of the old world economy, the bulk economy itself, that the U.S. has transitioned away from. We are a technology economy. We are an economy of software and services, and there is no one in this world that exports it better than us. The second largest exporter of technology is Israel. So on a competitive basis, the U.S. stands out as a singular dominant force in technology and the delivery of it geographically throughout the globe. Technology is so incredibly important in the index weighting and composition of the S&P 500, and we're witnessing it now as we enter in the next earnings period, where we have expectations that are very strong for mid 15, almost 17 or 18% EPS growth for the technology space. So, understanding technology being that part of the economy, again, in this conversation today, let's keep it first and foremost in our mind, and let's understand that fundamentally it provides a very strong and good foundation for this U.S. economy, which allows us to stand out against other economies. With all this being said, I'd like to now open up the conversation. Ben, Doug, Peter, I want to thank you for joining me on the call today. I think all of you would agree with me that it's a very important time to be having this conversation as we enter upon the second quarter of 2018. And I began this conversation talking about central banks and a little bit of the changes in particular that we're seeing here with the Federal Reserve as it relates to rate policy. So, Ben, if I could begin with you and ask you to share with all of those on the call today your view and the new fleet view on the rate structure here in the U.S., the Federal Reserve, global rates. Are we going to see a rise in inflation and the synchronized global growth that was the story in the last 4 to 5 months? Do you see that as remaining in place?
Great. Thank you, Joe. So our view on growth first in the U.S., is I'd call a moderate growth environment. For 2018, we expect GDP to be somewhere in the range of 2.5% to about 2.75%. This will likely come in the first quarter, be around 2% before picking up for the remainder of 2018 on the strength of the consumer. Synchronized growth, I do think we will continue to see synchronized growth across the world led by emerging markets. The differential in growth, EM versus DM may have peaked in the first quarter, but still is settling in at a good level for emerging markets, and I can expand on that as we go through here. Inflation, we see inflation trending in the 2% area, so not being overheated. This is due to a continued lack of wage pressures and moderate growth, which we think will keep inflation in check. You have technology, you mentioned that. I think global technology structurally will keep inflation low. You have a globalization of the economy, and then just in general, low global inflation. So all factors, I think, will keep inflation low. We see a low risk of a recession over the next couple of years. Again, we are expecting moderate growth, not overheated. We think the current economic cycle has at least another couple years. This has been extended out by continued, still accommodative monetary policy, that is being pulled back somewhat, and gradual rate hikes. So you've seen low inflation, low wage growth, and this has allowed the Fed to raise rates gradually. Now, you mentioned the somewhat recent rise in rates. You know, this year we've seen a rise in rates spurred by fear of stronger growth, you know, a little bit stronger, higher inflation, although more recently this has been moderated some on fear of a trade war and less concern with wage inflation. The curve, we've seen a flattening of the curve with the short end staying higher on expected Fed rate increases. We do expect in total three rate increases this year, so another two in 2018. But we do think the longer end of the U.S. Treasury curve will be kept on the lower due to ECB policy, low and in a lot of cases negative global yields. There's still $9.2 trillion of negative yields globally. So these factors we think will keep yields low on the long end of the U.S. Treasury curve. One thing to watch, though, you know, the ECB, they've talked about how, you know, starting October 2018, they're likely to or could end QE. So we'll have to keep an eye on that and see if that pressures yields higher. Our overall range for the 10-year, Joe, in 2018 is 2.5% to 3%. You know, possibly going to 3.25% if we do see stronger growth than we anticipate and inflation does tick higher. Now, this environment is our expectation, you know, moderate growth, low inflation, is generally good for fixed income credit. And we are overall still favorable on credit, although valuations have come in a ways. However, you mentioned this also, volatility has definitely picked up and the noise in the market has picked up in 2018, whether it's the fear of, you know, Fed rate increases, geopolitical noise, trade wars, politics, all concerns that have been more highlighted in the market so far this year.
Thank you, Ben. Doug,
thanks,
if I could turn to you and just talk real quickly. Ben mentioned a U.S. 10-year at 3.25%. I just want to walk back for a second and take everyone on this call back to early September of 2017. U.S. 10-year at that point was approaching 2%. It found its trough at 2.0144%. Subsequently, it's gotten as high as 2.9537. That was on February 21st. Doug, how should we be thinking about a rising rate environment, possibly inflation, although I'm not necessarily sure if we see that. I'd like your view if you see it. But a rising rate, modest inflation environment, what's the impact in general terms for small caps, the asset class, and more specifically, quality companies that you like to focus on in the asset class?
Okay, thank you, Joe. Well, I think there's two major things that happen, and they sort of offset each other to some extent. But number one is, you know, it sort of depends on why rates are rising. And if rates are going up because inflation's picking up modestly and business activity's improving, which is what I would argue has actually been happening since late last fall, where business activity has actually been very good, and inflation has picked up a little bit, but still pretty manageable by any stretch of the imagination. So, you know, and the impact that has on small companies, if it's a good business environment, which I think it has, then that generally is good for small caps. Small caps are going to perform well when business activity is stable and improving. Small caps run into trouble when business activity is doing the opposite, where it's shrinking or falling and companies are starting to miss earnings estimates, et cetera. So what we've seen since last fall and actually seen for quite a while is pretty strong business activity, and so that's good for small caps in general. The offset is many small cap companies, not typically the ones that we own in our portfolios, because most of those have little to no debt, but many small companies do have debt, and, you know, obviously their cost of capital rises as interest rates rise over time, and they have to roll over their debt at some point in time. And so that makes them less attractive on the margin. But usually the improvement in business activity will offset the modest increase in capital that people see. And for quality businesses, the low level of debt, you know, that they have, typically no debt at all, which was what we have in our portfolios, really the rise in rates has little to no impact on them in terms of, you know, fundamental interest rate costs going up.
Thank you, Doug. Peter, welcome to the call, and thank you for dialing in today. Peter, you and your team at Von Tobel, you've been managing markets, and I mentioned before the risk associated, and clearly in 18 it's back to an environment where investors and speculators have to assume more of that risk management than they had in years prior when the central banks kind of had their back, so to speak. You've seen many walls of worry for the markets to climb. Certainly in 2018, the list is as long as it's been in years prior. One could argue that central banks could be part of that, but there are geopolitical risks. There are domestic risks. There are certainly a divide in our domestic society. For all of us on the call, how is it that you look at these risks in the global market, and do you view any as being more prevalent than potentially impact than others?
Sure. Well, I think that's a great question, Joe. And also to go back to your opening comments about volatility. Before I answer the question, I'd like to say that I think it's a great time for a financial advisor to sit down with their clients. I mean, things have gone our way, things have gone your way for a long period of time, and now a lot of end users, a lot of the clients, they're concerned about this volatility. They're concerned about geopolitical risk. They're concerned about trade wars. So what do we do? How do we assuage them to own equities in the first place? And how are we going to limit risk in their specific portfolio, whether it be emerging markets or U.S. equities or international equities? And I think that's the true question, where, you know, we can now have a buy-in from the client as to what do I own? What can I own that's going to make me comfortable, that I can sleep at night with, no matter where that stock might be? And so traditionally, you know, how do you control this? How do you have, you know, a high alpha, low beta portfolio over a longer period of time? And that is the individual stocks that you buy, not the asset class itself. And, you know, we see flows into emerging markets, out of emerging markets. You know, you mentioned central banks, you know, interest rates are rising. This has traditionally not been good for emerging markets, but we don't see that correlation to individual companies. So if a business, and this is what the FA and the client have to come to an agreement on, what kind of portfolio do they want? Do they want high CapEx, high credit requirement, no pricing power, a low ROE portfolio, which seems to be doing better, especially in EM right now, or over time, is the high return on equity, high return on asset, high return on invested capital, high margin portfolio of sustainable growth going to get you where you want to be and sort of take some of the lumps out of the returns because of the underlying quality and sustainability of growth of the company? So, you know, we see a lot of risks, but also we see risks that are overblown. We see, you know, if you go back and look at Mexico before the election. So Hillary's ahead. You know, Mexico's fine. If Trump closes, the peso crashes, the Mexican market goes down. Then Hillary comes back and things get back to normal. Then Trump wins at Mexico, all from some perceived change in NAFTA or a perceived trade war. Well, it's our job to find stocks that are somewhat immune from that. Is Walmart in Mexico a casualty of a change in NAFTA? Is HDFC Bank in India have anything to do with higher interest rates? What's going to happen to Alibaba? What's going to happen to NetEase? What's going to happen to Baidu from a reform standpoint of view? So you've got to look at those things. And one of the reasons we run concentrated portfolios is that there's not that many companies that have, as Buffett would say, a moat around the business that in any economic environment they can perform. And that's how we take risk out, that the business will overcome, and the business has a history of overcoming difficult macroeconomic times or high volatility times. And that's how we control risk. And I think that message translated to an end user is a very powerful message.
So, you know, you just said something truly wonderful, and that's the communication component of what might be necessary in this risk management process in 2018. Gentlemen, what I'd like to ask all of you, and maybe I'll begin with Doug on this question, but it's the same question for all of you. When we talk about communication, we talk about a more volatile environment in 2018. We tend to look at the negative reaction to whether it be the political stories from Washington, D.C., the talks of a trade war with the Chinese. The negative reaction seems to first present itself in the business headlines. For each of you, and I'll begin with you, Doug, can you share with us how you might look at that as maybe an opportunity moment versus it being such a negative for your construction of the portfolio? And secondarily, when these moments arise, just kind of communicate with us, is there a way that you affect or you behave any differently than in ways you would in the past?
Sure, Joe. I think what we try to do is, you know, similar to what Peter just said, we're trying to find businesses that can survive and thrive in both good and bad times. You know, we don't know, and we don't think anybody else really knows when times are going to get tough and when times are going to get a lot better. But what we can figure out is, you know, how has a business performed historically in those good and bad times. So we don't think there's going to be a trade war. We think that cooler heads will prevail here, as already seems to be happening. But if it does, it would obviously create some more volatility short term. It would give us more opportunities to buy companies that we really like, probably at lower prices in the short run. But we were always buying businesses that can, you know, at least survive, if not even thrive, and even take market share if we get a slowdown in growth because of some global trade war that we're not predicting. But if it happened, our businesses aren't going to be losing money and going bankrupt and having all kinds of problems. The stocks may go down for a little while, but as we learned in 08 and 09, you know, it doesn't take long for quality businesses to recover in stock price terms even once you get exposed to this kind of downside volatility and unfortunate circumstance if and when it happens. So we're not on the edge of owning businesses that are going to completely fall apart if, you know, China stops trading with the U.S. And, oh, by the way, small companies, by and large, are a lot more immune than some of the large ones anyway. But if you go into a bad environment, they'll probably get hit as stocks anyway. But so despite the less direct Chinese exposure that we have, you know, we think that we're buying businesses that can do well even in tough times, and hopefully that'll continue to be the case.
Ben, how about the taxable fixed income area? Have you recognized, you know, some of the headwinds that we're witnessing right now in terms of politics and the trade war as a source of opportunity?
Yeah, absolutely, Joe. I mean, we try to, which we've been doing for years, try to look through the volatility in the market, look through the noise, and focus on investments that, in our view, offer good value, attractive yields, attractive spreads, and ultimately are fundamentally sound companies that could weather volatility in the market. You know, we, as true multi-sector managers, investing not only in the U.S., but Europe, Latin America, Asia, in multiple sectors, we have a very large opportunity set to find these opportunities. So we'll look at, we've seen, I'd say, a very modest effect this year from a standpoint of effect on the credit markets with the volatility. You had high yield widening, 25, 30 basis points, similar in emerging markets. Investment in corporates wider by 20, so nothing really significant, and that a lot of that has actually retraced and come back in the last 2 weeks. But we look at these type of situations and say, okay, if we see a pickup in volatility due to a trade war, which similar to Doug, we're not expecting a full blown trade war, but if there's a pickup in volatility due to that or a various factor, then we'll look at the fixed income market, look at bonds and companies that we think are attractive in our portfolios, and find the best value. It's something we've been doing for over 25 years and has worked.
Thank you. Peter, I want to talk specifically about the concerns with trade and turn your attention more towards the developments that we're seeing in both the Chinese economy domestically for them and the response that they possibly might have and the impact on potentially global growth. But the first component of that is domestically. They're trying to signal many economic reforms. Do you believe that the political developments that we're witnessing right now, will that obstruct their ability to successfully implement these?
Maybe. No, I don't mean to be so evasive, but just
no, that's a candid, authentic answer and the right one. So share why it's a maybe.
Yeah. That's what we have to, you know, it could. What it concerns us, you know, we own Alibaba, we own NetEase, we own Baidu, and, you know, we understand that the Xi government wants to put government board members. They want to sell those securities, in China. So those are the things you've got to look at, and you can't make a blanket statement. Reform is good, reform is bad. You know, how does the reform affect each one of the individual businesses? Or how does, you know, some macroeconomic event, you know, if you go back to 2015, you know, we own Carlsberg. The Russian ruble collapsed. Carlsberg does 40% of their business in Russia. That's material. That means that the earnings are no longer going to be sustainable. So you have to leave. It's more often that, you know, we don't find opportunity because of, you know, economic chaos or you know, a change in the economic the macro environment. It more makes us want to sell. But also, you know, going back to how do we handle this, and as you mentioned, communication, here's what one of the problems is. The problem is the financial advisor's clients likes the discussion about what's happening, the trade war, and puts too much emphasis on that in their decision-making. And it's hard for the FA. But the FA has to hold the line to say, this is why we own these companies. Now, you know, you talk about a trade war in Asia. Transpac is dead. Transpac maybe wasn't a good deal. We've done six individual treaties with out of 10 major countries, and one more recently with Korea. And I think the Chinese understand also that they have stolen our trade secrets, that they do, you know, dump aluminum on the marketplace, and that if something is going to happen. So, but the point is that we have to get away from that, the broader discussion, and say, listen, we own 45 stocks. The client is concerned. What is the net effect on what I own? And is it going to affect the sustainability of the earnings growth? Is it going to affect the margin? And if it does, what are you going to do? And if that question is posed to us, you know, when we come to the decision that reform in China or, you know, a change in interest rates or a currency in Mexico changing for some reason, we will have to make a decision as to what we do with that individual stock. We are not trying to give people access to broad markets. We're trying to give people access to individual businesses that have a direct connection to their clients' needs. Therefore, they have operating results. If we can buy those operating results at a reasonable price, we can transfer them as investment results to the end user.
Great. Doug, we're spending a lot of time on this call talking about the headwinds in the marketplace. You're very good at observing and reminding me at these calls and events that we do of some of the tailwinds that we might be witnessing. And I mentioned before, listen, we're witnessing, you know, probably the third consecutive quarter of the strongest earnings we're going to post since 2011. But also there are some fundamentally strong tailwinds that are persisting besides what I was talking about before from technology. So Is it all bad from Washington, D.C., or has, you know, the lifting of regulation, the tax reform, has that provided a lift in terms of confidence and free cash flow and earnings ability for these S&P 500 companies?
Yeah, I think deregulation in particular has helped certain industries. It's certainly helped energy. It's certainly helped the banks. I think the banks and the bank management teams, you know, talking to them fairly frequently, it was pretty obvious to us that when President Trump got elected that their mindset had changed almost overnight from the environment that they all believed they were operating in. And so, you know, behavior and your outlook and the sentiment can, you know, bank managements are people just like all of us and everybody else on the call. And, you know, when you have to go to work every day and you're worried about getting sued, you know, you tend not to do much, and you tend to be very risk-averse. And I think that clearly has changed, and I think that definitely has had a good impact on the economy overall. You know, and obviously there's some safeguards and mistakes that were made in 08 that need to be kept in place, and I think they've done a decent job of doing that. But like a lot of things in life, you know, they sort of overdid it, and now they're undoing part of that, and I think that's basically helped. So I think you've seen it in the energy area. You've seen it in the banking business to a large degree, that and banks, you know, whether you like them or not, loan growth is important to the economy. And then I think the other area, you've seen it in the small business. You know, small business in particular, if you look at the sentiment of small businesses, you know, in terms of confidence, it was down at pretty low levels before the election. And after the election, I think you've seen a pretty dramatic improvement. And now you're pretty much at all-time highs in terms of business confidence on the part of small businesses. And as most of you know, all the real hiring in this country happens in small businesses, not large ones. So I do think it's had an impact, and it's been positive. It's hard to tell exactly how much of it, you know, how much it's helped GDP over the last couple of years. But it definitely has been a good thing, I think, on the margin.
Excellent. For all of you that were thinking you had to rush off this call to beat the IRS tax filing deadline, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin just announced that you'll get an extension because the IRS website's down today, so you could enjoy the call in its full duration. let's get back to it. Ben, I want to turn my attention. You know, I spoke a lot about the domestic rate environment, but I'd like to talk a little bit about global fixed income markets, and clearly they're very interconnected. You and Newfleet, as a true multi-sector manager investing across many countries and sectors, can you talk how you look at the global fixed income market and any opportunity that you might be seeing? And also tell us, you know, when you're talking about opportunities you might be seeing, there's always the opportunity and what to avoid, and is there something out there that you're avoiding?
Definitely. Thank you, Joe. Yeah, I would agree. More than ever, the global fixed income markets are very interconnected. You know, what the ECB does with QE or the Bank of Japan does, or even political or economic news in countries like Brazil, Argentina, or Russia, which has been in the news more recently, they're going to affect the global credit markets. They'll affect the U.S. bond market. So when we look at opportunities and we look at cross sectors, you know, we're looking at the interconnection between markets. We're looking at, I mentioned, you know, not just corporate sectors, corporate high quality, investment grade, bank loans. We're looking at securitized sectors. And we're looking across all countries, U.S., Latin America, Europe, Asia, as I mentioned. So we kind of look at it individually, but also holistically across the globe. And, you know, opportunities right now that we are seeing, you know, first from a high level, I mentioned before, we still are overall favorable on fixed income spread sectors over U.S. Treasuries and agency mortgages, and we expect them to outperform for the remainder of 2018. You know, spread sectors continue to be supported by your very good fundamentals, or I would call good fundamentals. Defaults are low in high yield, for example. They're 3.2% and trending lower over the next 12, 18 months. Bank loan defaults are 2.4%, so historically low. You still have very favorable conditions for borrowers. You have, in our view, solid but not overheated economic growth, low inflation, and still overall very good demand for credit by investors, both in the U.S. And outside the U.S. You know, on the other side of the coin, you know, valuations, I would say, are kind of fair. They're historically on the tighter side when you look at long-term averages, but I would call them fair when you kind of look at spreads, yields, and then overall fundamentals and so forth that I mentioned. You know, so given these factors or the way we're positioned in our fixed income portfolios, you know, we are near our long-term averages when you look at our total below investment grade and our total foreign and emerging market exposure. You know, we're not at the very high end, and we're not at the very low end. So this gives us, if we do see volatility pick up and it does cause a sell-off in the credit markets, it gives us plenty of opportunity and plenty of room to add to fixed income credit. I will also say that in our view, no one fixed income sector is really cheap. And there's a lot of differentiation in sectors here. So selection, which I think is always important, whether it's credit or country selection, becomes even more important here where valuations are. And I would not want to own the high yield index or the ag index, for example. There are a couple of sectors that specific fixed income sectors that we are more favorable on. First, on asset-backed securities, and specifically, I'm referring to some of the out-of-index asset backs that benefit from good consumer fundamentals, things such as subprime auto, consumer loans, franchise receivable deals. You know, we look for deals with good structures, generally good credit support and credit enhancement to protect from losses. We also like the non-agency residential mortgage market. This sector benefits from a healthy housing market. You've seen about 5% year-over-year growth the last 2 years. Mortgage credit is in good shape. So here we favor the non-agency space over agencies. We like that additional spread pickup and are comfortable with mortgage credit. In a lot of cases, a lot of these bonds tend to be less sensitive to a move in rates. And then one more sector we like here, we like bank loans. Valuations here look attractive compared to a lot of other fixed income sectors. You have a yield to maturity of around 5.3%, which again compares well on a yield basis to a lot of other sectors. And you look at bank loans versus high yield for corporate high yield, for example, you are only giving up about 1% or 100 basis points of yield to go from high yield to bank loans. And that average, historically, it's averaged around 150 basis points. So it looks attractive from that measure. And then add on top of the sector, bank loans also benefits from rising rates, rising LIBOR, which we've seen move up based on the floating rate nature of the coupons within that sector. A couple areas that we are underweight. First, treasuries, I mentioned that. We're underweight treasuries. We are underweight agency mortgages, and then also underweight commercial mortgage-backed securities from a valuation perspective, and municipals, tax-free munis, or taxable munis, excuse me, we're also underweight.
All right. Thank you, Ben. I want to ask one final question, and for all of you on the call, thank you for your patience, and I hope you've enjoyed the content so far, and please prepare as we open the lines for your inclusion here, where you're going to ask some questions of the panelists. But before I do that, Doug, I just want to come back to you. I mentioned before technology. Obviously, everyone on the call is well aware of Facebook scandal and seeing the CEO of Facebook sitting before Congress and the Senate. I'd like your view on if this scandal is going to reshape technology in any way, both from a regulatory standpoint or the consumer's willingness to continue to participate in these social platforms and therefore how advertisers would react accordingly.
Well, Joe, I think the simple answer is time will tell, and it's tough to know at this particular point in time. I think that, what we're seeing so far is that, this delete Facebook or Facebook, no longer being useful or people turning their backs on it really hasn't happened in any material way. Maybe it'll pick up steam later. I don't know, but it's certainly not happening now. And it's sort of ironic, I talk to a lot of my friends and I ask them about Facebook. They say, oh, no, I'm not using Facebook, but I love Instagram. And, of course, they don't realize that Facebook owns Instagram as well. So it's sort of it's sort of interesting to see what happens here. But and I think if you listen to any of the testimony that Zuckerberg gave in front of Congress and the questions that were asked, it's pretty obvious that there isn't much consensus on the Hill about what to do about some of these issues. In fact, there's a, you know, alarming amount of ignorance about what is actually being done and what Facebook already does and how the Internet works and how Facebook works. So I don't know. I don't think there's any groundswell of a political consensus on what to do to regulate them if they wanted to. So I don't know what's going to happen, but I do know that if the ROI for advertisers doesn't change and the business model isn't interrupted in any big way, you know, by in terms of what advertisers can get on ROI on Facebook, that they're going to continue to advertise on Facebook, which is exactly what's happening, at least so far, because it's still a great return compared to pretty much any other medium you can take a look at these days. And, you know, so unless users go elsewhere, like MySpace, you have some sort of mad big blow-up over time, and where people really get disenchanted with the service or something materially better occurs out there, which I've yet to see in any material way. You know, I think that, you know, Facebook is sort of a unique case in terms of privacy, et cetera. And these are big political, societal issues that people are going to have to deal with over time. I mean, I'm not trying to minimize, you know, privacy. I mean, I think that is very, very important. But, you know, as he's pointed out many times, if you want the service to be free, you know, things don't happen for free. You have to figure out some way to monetize this business in order to allow people to do that. So stay tuned. I think it's to be determined. You know, I think in the meantime, you know, unlike the early 2000 time period, I mean, these are tremendous businesses and, you know, with tremendous cash flow, tremendous earnings. And going back to your original point, which I think Americans in this country completely underestimate, is just how much of a technology lead we've had, not just lately, but for the last 30 or 40 years in this country relative to the rest of the world. There's effectively no competition except a few Chinese companies in most of the areas of technology around the globe. So it's a superior competitive advantage that we have. And even if you grow up in one of those other areas and you're a technology person and you want to start a business, guess what? You're going to move to Silicon Valley or somewhere in the U.S. to do it. So anyway, I hope that helps.
It certainly does, and I thank you for the answer to that question.
Okay. Thank you, operator. Thank you, Joe, and thank you, panelists. Very much appreciated, and we thank you all for joining us today and listening to this panel discussion. Portfolio-specific insights can be found in our quarterly podcast series, Virtus Voices, which is accessible on virtus.com. If you have any additional questions or would like further information, I would encourage you to visit our website or call us at 1-800-243-4361. Joe, Ben, Doug, Peter, thank you all very much for your time today, and everybody, have a great evening. Thank you.